Looking for your own personal bailout, perhaps?
You see, you are actually the victim of an economic system that is designed, deliberately designed to get you in debt and to keep you in debt for the rest of your life. Credit card debt is designed to never be paid off.
The deepening recession has supercharged the consumer bailout industry. People who say they will eliminate your debt or tell you what you never have to pay off. Finding a rescue package for people who owe less than, say, $10.5 trillion or $100 billion or $800 million, you know, just plain folks. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 27th, and that certainly is the irony, right, John, that it's those companies, those who are helping consumers deal with debt, that actually do really well
big
in
bailouts,
bad economic times.
Big bailouts easy, little bailouts hard.
Good morning, not so hard. Good morning, everyone. This morning we have Ben Smith from Politico.com, who broke the story of major tensions in the John McCain presidential campaign. Also, we have a report on Iraq. This is an important week for Iraqis fighting insurgents and, well, baseball fever. Some people say it's more like baseball flu.
World Series, world markets. We have some headlines. They're taking a dive this morning on fears of a dramatic global recession. Europe's major indices are down once again between 4 and 6%. Big drops in Asian markets. Also, Hong Kong's Hang Seng lost nearly 13%. The Nikkei is at a 26-year low. The Prime Minister of Japan, Taro Aso, has announced new measures to help bolster his country's economy. And the South Korean government has announced the largest drop in its interest rate in history.
And it's all battleground states all the time as the candidates begin the final full week of campaigning. Barack Obama and John McCain both start the day in northern Ohio and end up in Pennsylvania. In Canton, Ohio, Obama is expected to deliver his, quote, closing arguments just after noon. John McCain will start in Cleveland, and he'll continue to focus his attacks on Obama. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid saying they are tax and spend Democrats.
Syria says the U.S. has committed, quote, a terrible crime. Syrian officials say four American helicopters killed eight civilians in a raid on a farm along the border with Iraq. U.S. forces in western Iraq have denied they were involved in the incident, although we spoke with a correspondent from the L.A. Times who suggests that maybe the U.S. has admitted that it was involved in something. No details at this point.
Gas prices have dropped nearly 53 cents a gallon in the past 2 weeks. Oil industry analyst Trilby Lundberg says it's all part of the global economic troubles.
The record price drop at the pump that occurred 2 weeks ago has now been completely destroyed. The price fell 53 cents in the past 2 weeks to $2.78 per gallon.
Oil prices have fallen to a 17-month low. It's trading just below $62 a barrel.
Campus of the University of Central Arkansas is in lockdown after the shooting deaths of two on campus, and officials say they have one suspect in custody and are looking for three others. The World Series is on. Philadelphia Phillies one game away from winning it all. They beat Tampa Bay 10-2 last night in a snoozer.
And we're looking at economic numbers as we have been. How are you dealing with them? Are you getting a second job to pay your bills? Are you looking to debt counselors?
Second job? You're lucky to have one job. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. The economy has a big picture, and it certainly has a small picture. And if you're looking at your own dwindling 401k, maybe it feels a little smaller after the last few weeks. Once again, markets are poised on Wall Street for a decline at the open. But with this level of volatility, it's almost impossible to know if the end of the day is going to resemble the beginning of the day. At the very least, the volatility suggests there's little confidence anywhere in the world for a turnaround in the markets, and we haven't seen a bottom yet. Declines of negative 10% or more in Asia, continuing around Europe, and as I said, a negative opening suspected on Wall Street. In the last several weeks, there's been a procession of layoffs announced by the blue chip companies, from General Electric to virtually all of the airlines, and including the automakers, who are in serious trouble. We've decided to speak with Alvin Hall, financial consultant and author of Show Me the Money. He's in the studio with us to take an actual look at macro and micro issues in this economy, to try to get a perspective both from the standpoint of an economist and for a consumer. Alvin, thanks so much for coming in.
Glad to be here this morning.
You know, let's talk about where is the wave. In the beginning, the beginning rumblings of all of this economic crisis involved house prices, declining property values, maybe people foreclosing on their mortgages. That's pretty easy for consumers to monitor. Now it's expanded considerably. Where do you think the wave is now? And from a consumer perspective, when does it hit the beach and maybe we start to turn around?
Well, right now the wave is happening in the new area of probably credit cards. As people lose their jobs and they're unable to make their credit card payments, very similar to the way they can't make their mortgage payments, they start to default on credit cards. Most people did not realize that the credit cards had been packaged like mortgages and also sold on around the world in very similar types of debt securities. So that's the next wave that's coming that people will see. When credit card defaults start, you'll see the banks get into even more trouble, and therefore other values will start to contract in the economy.
And I guess the attractiveness of these packaged securities from a credit card perspective is that you're not talking about 7% yields here. You're talking about 18% yields, 20% yields.
Yes.
That's the interest rate on my credit card.
Exactly. And most people only make the minimum payments every month. So you had a reasonably predictable cash stream, and notice I said reasonably predictable cash stream, that when these securities were rated by Moody's and Standard & Poor's, they predicted that the cash streams would be much more consistent than they're turning out to be. As the economy contracts and you're unable to make your credit card payment, which we know you will be able to make it, John.
You know that, huh? You
exactly.
Know that. Just by looking at me, you can
tell. I'll loan you the money.
Wow.
I like the way you think, Alvin.
And what happens then? People start to default, and those securities also start to lose their value quickly.
What you've described is a wave that's working through the availability of credit, it seems.
Yes.
Is the impact of multiple credit defaults in the credit card realm going to mean that if I'm standing in line in the supermarket, that decline message is going to come up a lot more as I'm standing in line? That people are going to maybe be told, you know, we actually can't give you your groceries today, or you can't buy that TV, and that we're going to start seeing those declines more frequently.
Yes, we'll see the credit card companies start to restrict credit use. In fact, a friend of mine who has a credit card was told that his credit line was reduced from $20,000 down to $4,000 because they said they thought he was in an industry, i.e. financial services. He had a low-paying job relatively in that industry, and they said that they didn't think that he could carry that credit
anymore.
Wait
a minute. There was nothing about his behavior that caused them to do that?
No,
they basically recalculated the stuff on the books.
Exactly. But you see that you saw that happen in Britain about a year ago, where both Egg and Citibank decided to willy-nilly cancel, I think it was 300,000 or some unbelievable number of credit cards, just because they deemed the people to be at risk.
And that's really common, though. Haven't many credit card companies at this point reduced the maximum on some of their customers just across the board, regardless of behavior?
Yes, they look at where you charge. If you charge, for example, at a discount store more than you do at a high-end store, they look at what financial services industry you're in, whether you're in banking or investment banking, or whether you're working in some related industry. And then they say, this person may be at risk given their credit card payments in the past, so we need to protect ourselves now.
And there's no regulation on that.
No, there's no regulation.
They can cut you off. They
exactly.
can just basically say, sorry, we don't know. They can get rid of their own toxic assets without any sort of federal oversight.
Thanks to that wonderful change in the law in the 70s that got rid of usury laws in America.
Right.
Many people don't remember the time when interest rates were very high, and New York City had a law that capped interest rates. So therefore, on credit cards, you could only go up to a certain amount, but interest rates in the general economy was very high. Citibank was among the early banks that led the movement to get rid of usury laws in America, and they succeeded with Congress.
And now it's almost reversed. It's the credit card interest rates that are really high, and the other ones that are really, really low. Mortgage rates are relatively low.
Exactly.
Let's talk about interest rates for a moment. What is the story? I mean, you've got the dollar rising.
Yes.
You've got Treasury notes going to zero as people try to park their money safely. But mortgage rates seem to be spiking, and the difficulty for consumers who actually need to take out loans seem like they're just going to get worse.
I think they're going to get worse because the banks are scared. The banks made bad loans. Now the pendulum is swinging all the way in the opposite direction, and they're saying, oh, we need to be even more restrictive now than we've been in the past. And so interest rates are going up because they're putting such tight strictures on everyone.
And so what does that do for the housing crisis? Clearly, it's critical that homeowners who are not going to be able to pay those mortgages in the next year or two get some kind of help. What do you expect to see there?
I expect to see banks attempt to negotiate with you and you individually, but I don't think they really have an overall plan to help people deal with the mortgage crisis at all.
Well,
I think banks are really looking at it on an individual basis.
Does Congress need to step in?
I think Congress does need to step in, and essentially, I hate to use this word, but they need to make them come up with a plan to help people who are on that edge, because it's very clear that in America, the feeling of security, the feeling of well-being is very much related to the value of your house.
Right.
For decades, it was a way of enforced savings in America. The concept of buying a house was that you would put your money in a house over time and it would go up. Gradually in the past decade or so, housing has become for many an investment, a dangerous shift in the attitude toward property. So I think banks need to help people go back and look at housing as a way of enforced savings.
Well, you say banks are sort of going at this piecemeal. We spoke with David Leonhardt of the New York Times last week, who said that if we were to bail out individual mortgage holders, it would be insanely expensive order of many, many trillions of dollars. In the meantime, an industry has sort of grown up which claims that it can get you the deal that the Feds got or that AIG got through dealing with debt elimination companies. There's a company called Debt America. Credithealth.com, they're all taken.
Yes.
And I don't know anything about any of the individual companies, but how do you assess this industry making claims that they can get you a bailout deal that's commensurate with what AIG got, for instance?
No one can deliver a miracle in this economy. So if people are telling you that we can get your credit right, that we can go out and help you, you need to read the fine print. In some cases, they'll try to attach your outstanding debt to your house or some other property. Sometimes all they do is send out letters. Basically,
what do you mean send out letters?
Send out letters to your creditors saying, you know, help us to restructure your debt.
Well, you can do that on your own.
You can do all of this on your own. But John, the problem is that when people get very stressed, they want there to be a father figure or some authority figure to help them make a decision.
Do you play that role sometimes?
Well, I play that role more as a psychologist, I would say. I sit down and say, no, calm yourself down and think about a way you can structure this. All you have to come up with is a step-by-step plan, and you don't have to accomplish this plan every day. You can do one task every single day, and you're moving forward. But I think most people think, I want to hand this off to somebody else who's going to take the pressure off my mind and make me feel good. And that it's that desire to feel better about the situation and give up the responsibility that drives people to these companies. And they're going to be successful, and people will be hurt, and we'll watch again as they take, you know, millions out from people, and then the government will come in and say, oh, I'm so sorry this happened, and now we'll regulate them after the fact.
So your view, and based on your experience, and you've been doing this for a while.
Yeah, for a long time.
Is the only way to really feel good about that pile of whatever it is that's driving you crazy financially is to pick up a shovel and start taking care of it one shovelful at a time, and there are ways to do that.
There are ways to do it, and anyone can structure a plan for themselves. They just need to have the courage to pick up the phone and start negotiating and be firm, be consistent, and the key point is only to make a promise that you know you can keep.
Advice from Alvin Hall, financial consultant and author, who's joining us all hour. He's author of Show Me the Money. He'll be around with us for the rest of the hour, and as he says, you know, banks have incentives to negotiate. There are really, I mean, they don't want to declare that you are bankrupt. They would rather actually renegotiate. But so people do have options.
But this idea that you pointed out, doing it one homeowner at a time, I mean, that just seems like it would take centuries to get through all of the people who are potentially going to be in trouble, who are in trouble today and who will continue to be in trouble in the next year or two.
Yeah, probably the banks are looking for a way out. And so if people can come up with a plan, hey, what if I did this? Maybe they'll say yes. Anyway, Alvin Hall has the wisdom for us this hour.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Record market declines, continuing layoffs, and talk of global recession. How you doing on your financial plan B there, America and everyone else? We're talking all hour with financial consultant Alvin Hall, who can answer your questions about what you should do next if you are considering a plan B. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Alvin, you following the election?
Yes, I am.
All right, well, sit tight for this, Adar.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you know, Alvin and John, just 8 days to go until the nation votes on the next president. And on the Republican side, there are reports that all is not well in the campaign.
Joe the plumber said it sounded to him like socialism. Yeah! And now is not the time to experiment with that. Yes.
That's Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin talking about Barack Obama's plans, economic plans and tax plans. She was firing up a crowd in Tampa, Florida, but was that comment sanctioned by the McCain campaign? In the final intense sprint to the finish line, there are reports of what some call a Palin insurgency. Political blogger Ben Smith broke that story. He's seeing increasing signs of tension in the McCain-Palin camp. He joins us now. Good morning, Ben, and welcome back.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
So you describe Sarah Palin as going, quote, rogue. Explain.
Well, that's how some of her kind of internal allies described her. And I mean, what I was told basically is that she kind of had grown increasingly unhappy with how the McCain camp had kind of handled her, had rolled her out. They, meanwhile, had grown, you know, increasingly unhappy with how she was performing, you know, and so she's, you know, basically stopped taking their advice. It's a very frosty relationship with the former Bush people who he sent, you know, out on the plane to tell her what to do. Got to the point where yesterday, I mean, the story of the day basically became her defending herself from this for having been bought this $150,000 worth of clothes, and then the McCain people telling reporters, well, you know, we didn't give her that to say. That wasn't in her prepared remarks.
Well, essentially said she's not wearing those clothes, right?
She said she's not wearing them, and the sort of people around her said, like, look, she didn't buy them. She wasn't running around Neiman Marcus grabbing stuff off the racks. That was out of control McCain staffers. I mean, to which the McCain people respond, you know, she's an adult. She should have known the clothes came from somewhere.
But you got to have a point there. I mean, I find myself, you know, whatever I may think about her politics, sympathetic with Sarah Palin on this point. It seems like they have just sort of run her like a hamster in a wheel, and she's pushing back. Well, good for her.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that is how she feels. And I think, you know, it's part of a sign of how many people inside that campaign are more worried about what happens, you know, next month when Barack Obama is the president-elect than they are about what happens this week. I mean, really, people around her are concerned that this is going to kind of tarnish her going forward, that the McCain people are going to blame her for a defeat, and so they're trying to preempt that.
We're going to get to the finger-pointing, but there's certainly been a whole series of statements that she's made that contradict the McCain position. I mean, she called their robocalls irritating to a camera. Let's listen to what she told Brian Williams in an interview with NBC.
Did I hear you just agree to release your medical records?
The medical records, so be it. If that will allow some curiosity seekers perhaps to have one more thing that they can either check the box off, that they can find something to criticize perhaps.
She questioned whether or not the McCain campaign should have pulled out of Michigan. How would you describe this public contradiction of the McCain campaign's position on some of those issues?
Well, I mean, I think it's deeply unhelpful to the campaign because, you know, there's 8 days left, and each one of them that gets spent discussing the differences between McCain and Palin is not spent discussing the differences between McCain and Obama. In fact, she's also, I think McCain was very concerned about how to deal with the Democrats' proposal for a big stimulus package for lots of spending, and they were all debating it internally, and then Palin went on a conservative talk radio show and came out against it, which sort of settled the matter.
Could you sort of break down some of the internal dynamics inside the campaign?
Sure. McCain, you know, in the early summer, basically turned the campaign over to people who'd worked on Bush's 2004 campaign, Steve Schmidt, Nicole Wallace, and those were the people who really kind of took charge of Sarah Palin and decided that, I think basically decided, agreeing with the portrayal of her in the, you know, in the press, that she was not ready, that, you know, he'd picked her, that it was a brilliant stunt in some ways, but that she, you couldn't let her go and talk to reporters because it was going to be a disaster, decided to control her very carefully, very much limit the access, give her very tightly memorized scripts, you know, memorized answers to questions, and you know, when she bombed on Katie Couric, the thing, you know, she basically said, well, you know, I would have done better if I'd been allowed to kind of to, you know, to speak more freely. They still say, I mean, ultimately, you know, she may be complaining, but she was the one who was unable to answer simple questions in this interview. So that's sort of the argument that's going on in there.
Ben, this is Alvin. Do you think she is shifting and looking to her life after this election? Because it seems as if she's sort of cultivating herself to be a pundit on a news show even after she has left Alaska, to me.
I'm not sure what's, you know, what's in her head. And in fact, I mean, she's got 2.5 more years of being governor. She's forbidden by law during that period from having outside income. So I don't think she's going to have a cable show instantly. I think she's maybe more positioning herself to be a force within the party, to be, you know, potentially a presidential nominee at some point. But whatever she's doing, there's certainly a cadre within the party, within the campaign, that sees her going forward as kind of their horse. And they're trying to set her up.
A Ben, horse, not a pit bull.
Yeah, I think she's probably tired of that one at this point.
Yes.
Ben, how much of this reported disgruntlement and tension within the campaign is characteristic of a campaign going into the final week this far down in the polls with a lot of questions about strategy and tactics?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of it is that. A lot of it's standard. This is a lot to be really between the two principals, between to see the vice presidential nominee go this far out, really be doing stuff kind of on her own, is pretty unusual.
And so what do you think we will see in these remaining 8 days? What are their options in terms of trying to make up some ground against Obama, Biden?
Well, I mean, at this point, we're really talking about the map, first of all, and you know, they're gonna, they've just decided that to roll the dice on Pennsylvania, a state where they're badly behind, where a Republican hasn't won since maybe '88, and you know, and to try to find some traction there, kind of culturally, it's a place that hasn't particularly been hugely friendly to Obama, although he's, you know, really doing quite well in the polls there, and they have not found a sort of new line of attack that really seems to be biting, although what they've been attacking him for is the suggestion that he would kind of, as he had said, spread the wealth around, raise taxes.
Okay, Ben Smith, thanks for joining us as always.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ben Smith is a Politico.com blogger, and he broke the story on the McCain campaign and some of the tensions that perhaps are existing there now.
It's going to be a tough 8 days for both campaigns, I think, whether they're throwing Hail Marys at the goalpost or if they're trying to articulate their message.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Femi Okeh has just joined us with some headlines.
Thank you. The time is 28 minutes to the top of the hour. Oil prices fell below $63 a barrel today. That's a 17-month low. This comes despite OPEC's decision on Friday to cut production by 1.5 million barrels. The Syrian government is condemning a U.S. strike on its territory near the Iraqi border as serious aggression. Damascus reports that four children are among the eight people dead. A U.S. military official said that they were targeting al-Qaeda-linked foreign fighters crossing into Iraq. A Guantanamo Bay prisoner accused of creating propaganda for al-Qaeda has performed an about-face. He'd vowed not to come to his war crimes trial today. He called them a legal farce. But the Pentagon says that they do expect him to appear. He's the second person to face trial in Guantanamo since he opened in 2002. The Philadelphia Phillies blew out the Tampa Bay Rays last night with a score of 10-2. But the Rays manager Joe Maddon says the team has got to get back in the series one game at a time.
I don't even like to talk about three in a row. The mantra has been one game at a time. If we could have 3 one-game winning streaks, I'd be very happy right now. And I really want us to approach it that way.
Thinking positive, the Phillies host the next game tonight.
Thanks very much, Femi. We're now going to look at some economic numbers, asking how you personally are responding to difficult times. Are you picking up an extra job? Have you lost your job and you're looking for a job, so you're spending less in your life? If you have any questions for financial advisor Alvin Hall, give us a call. Adam Lowe asks on our website, when the first wave of stimulus checks went out earlier this year, we saw some good results of that action, although the effects dwindled out by July. Now, take $770 billion and divide that by the population in the U.S., and that would grant everyone $25,000. Alvin Hall, what do you think of that idea?
I don't think it's a good idea, actually. I think people need money, but the government is racking up more debt by doing this. And what are people going to do with the money? They're going to use it to cover the expenses for a period of time. How long will it last? I think this situation is going to go on for so long that when the government gives us money, we'll use it to cover the expenses, but then they'll have to do it again and again and again. It would be better if they took a bigger picture point of view and maybe look back in the past and try to redo some ideas that came out of the Great Depression or something like that.
All right. So we're taking questions all hour from Alvin Hall, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. What questions do you have about financially moving forward for Alvin Hall? And do you have a plan B? And if so, share it with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Meanwhile, we are going to talk about what's going on in Iraq. Joining us from Baghdad now is Quil Lawrence, BBC correspondent, to talk about two important milestones in the evolution of U.S. policy in Iraq. One involves the Status of Forces Agreement, which seems to be on the table, although it's stalled in the Iraqi parliament. And a smaller detail, which by the end of this week involves the Sunni Awakening Councils. Those are the Sunni insurgents or Sunni tribal leaders who were paid by the United States to be involved in security arrangements. Those councils are going to be paid by Iraqi officials by the end of this week. Quil Lawrence, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
First of all, how is this going to work by the end of the week? What's exactly going to happen that wasn't happening before? We understand the U.S. has been paying these Awakening SAWA councils, but how's that going to be shifted?
Well, officially, the Iraqi Defense Ministry took over administration of these Sunni irregulars at the first of the month. But the real test will be the payday, which usually comes at the end of the month. The Americans had always been paying them on the last day of the month. It doesn't look like the Iraqi army is quite ready to do that. And we'll have to see how that plays out with Sunnis. If the Shiite-dominated Iraqi government tells all of these Sunni fighters, many of them former insurgents, well, your check is going to be a little bit late. We'll get it to you next week. Will they wait a week? Will the Iraqi government actually get them paid then? How long will it take before they get very aggravated? There's a lot of suspicion between these two groups.
Well, let's talk about some tape that you actually got in Baghdad. This first piece of tape is from a U.S. military official describing what I think you've described there is the complexity of this handover.
Each one of these is a, you know, a SAWA member who is under contract with the coalition that, you know, we've now registered as a Government of Iraq employee. Hopefully, some of these individuals will get taken into the Iraqi security forces on a permanent basis, either in the army or the Iraqi police at a later time.
Now, Quil Lawrence, that sounds like that a U.S. official is saying that the U.S. is going to deputize these people as members of the Iraqi government, but the Iraqi government still has to hire them.
Well, that was Major Kendrick Robbins of the 2-6 Infantry, actually about 18 miles southeast of Baghdad in the town of Salman Pak. He and his men for weeks have been fighting what I called the manning the fighting photocopiers of the 2-6 Infantry. They were by hand collating, photocopying all of these records for the payroll for their local 3,300 Sahwa volunteers. Essentially, they want to turn this program over to the Iraqis. It's a program they consider very successful. They want to hand it over to the Iraqi army, and in the long term, they should then be able to leave and let the Iraqis run their own affairs. There's not a lot of confidence that that's going to happen. They were trying to do all the paperwork so that there could be no excuse for the Iraqi government not to pay them.
All right, let's get a sense of, on the street, what the level of suspicion is about how this transition is going to take place. Listen to this.
Do you want American forces to leave Iraq?
Maybe, but I now is very bad to Iraq when the American forces leave Iraq. Now, directly, Iranian occupied the Iraq. Iranian government occupied the Iraq. By their parties, many parties now working in Iraq behalf of the Iranian government.
Two levels of suspicion there, Quill Lawrence. One, that Iran is going to invade, and secondly, that they don't necessarily believe that the Iraqi government is capable of doing what the U.S. government has done.
That was a leader of the Sahwa in the town of Salman Pak, who gave his name only as Abu Ghufran, which is a pseudonym. And he's not saying that the Iranians are going to invade. He thinks they already have. He thinks that Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is essentially an Iranian puppet. Now, Nouri al-Maliki has ties to Iran, so do most of the Shiite parties here who took shelter in Iran during the Saddam Hussein years in Iraq. But they think that this government's nothing but a puppet. They want to fight against what they call the Persian army, and they're talking about the Iraqi army. When they say that.
Well,
so, yes, I think distrust is an understatement.
Certainly an understatement if Iraqis believe that Iraq is a province of Iran these days. Quill Lawrence, BBC correspondent based in Baghdad, thank you very much. Talking about the difficult sort of tribal allegiances as the U.S. attempts to hand over to the Iraqi authorities relations that they had managed with the tribal leaders in the Sunni population in Iraq for the last year under the Petraeus troop surge. All that very, very complicated and interesting, and the end game far from over.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adoree Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and let's talk some baseball. We're already into the World Series, and actually the Phillies are one game away of taking it. Who would have thought it? Jeff Beresford Howe joins us from San Francisco. He's a freelance baseball writer. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
You had to stay up really, really late to see that first game in Philly over the weekend because rain delayed it until like 2 in the morning. Last night's game, 10-2 Phillies blowout. Boy, the Rays look like they're choking after this drama of the lowest paid payroll making it to the series. I don't know. What do you think, Jeff?
Well, I would say that the Phillies are choking just as much as the Rays. They just happen to be winning some of the games. The Phillies have set a standard that is unequaled in baseball history for failing to drive in runners. I mean, they're playing bad baseball and getting away with it.
And it's sort of a subprime mortgage crisis there on the basis for the Phillies. I mean, they have so many people who never make it in. What do you think is the reason for the Phillies winning? I mean, what is it, the bullpen?
Cole Hamels starting in game one. Their bullpen's been effective. And primarily, though, the main reason is the Tampa Bay Rays have fallen apart in the field and they've fallen apart at the plate.
Why do you call this the worst World Series in the history of baseball? I mean, you didn't grow up with Ty Cobb or anything, did you?
No, I'm not quite that old,
right,
no.
Right,
it's a systemic failure all the way down from Major League Baseball management and Fox starting the games too late and then actually ending up playing one of the games at near 2 in the morning. The umpiring has been disastrously bad. Four different umpires have made terrible, terrible mistakes. The stars in the series, the two stars in the Phillies and the three stars on the Rays, have contributed virtually nothing. In the Phillies' case, that changed on Sunday night. But in the other three games, we haven't seen anything from any of the really good players. It's just been a terrible series.
But listen to these announcers try to maintain the level of excitement. Will you, Jeff?
Trevor Miller. And that ball is absolutely hammered. 10-2.
Snore. 10-2.
I've never heard an announcer in my whole life get more excited about a 10-2 score.
You know, this is a real failure of the series to cap off what was really a pretty successful baseball season during the regular season because there were so many great races going on. Do you attribute it to the fact that these are two small market teams, relatively, and that ultimately baseball just takes second fiddle this late in the year to the NFL?
No, I just think part of it's just random, you know. You get two good teams, and the Phillies and the Rays are both good teams, and they're just both playing bad baseball at the same time right at the end of the year, and that happens. And during the course of the season, it all evens out. During the World Series, nothing evens out. It's right there in front of you.
But does baseball have to accept these start times from the television networks and from, you know, the NFL?
You know, as John McCain says, that's above my pay grade. Or is that Obama? I forget which. I think it's terrible.
It's just an indication of how much competition there is in sports at this time. It's sort of prime time and also prime season. Jeff Beresford Howe, thanks so much for joining us from
You're
San
welcome.
Francisco. Thanks, Jeff. He's a freelance writer who writes about baseball, joining us, as I said, from the Bay Area.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 27th, and Femi Oke has just joined us with some headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Deliberations in the trial of Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens have to start again. The judge will appoint an alternate juror today after one left last week because her father died. This means a verdict could be delayed until after the election. Stevens is facing a tough re-election bid as he fights for his seventh term in office. The countries of Hungary and Ukraine will receive bailouts from the IMF. The organization says it will inject more than $16 billion into Ukraine. The exact amount for Hungary is still being worked out. World markets continue to plummet today. Japan's Nikkei index was down more than 6% and hit its lowest point since 1982. Europe followed, and the benchmark indices in Britain, France and Germany are all down more than 3%. The Dow futures are down around about 200 points. And a NATO ship has successfully escorted a cargo ship to port in Somalia, and that's its first such mission since arriving off the coast of Somalia this weekend. NATO forces are there to help reduce pirate attacks in the region, and there have been dozens so far this year. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi. So with markets tanking, we're looking for wisdom from our listeners as to how they're dealing with the financial crisis. What are you most concerned about? What are you sensitive about? In your experience, Alvin Hall, who's a financial consultant who's with us, is it harder to get yourself out of debt or harder to get a new job?
Ooh, that's a very good question, John. I would say historically it's been to get out of debt because typically it'll take you four or five times longer to get out of debt than it does to take you to get into debt. But right now, if you're in certain industries and you're looking for a job, you are facing truly difficult times. Let's say that you were the administrative assistant for an investment banker. How many of these people have been laid off? Hundreds. So you're out there competing for a job. I think for a lot of those people, they're going to have to reinvent themselves and leave that industry forever.
Debt first, reinvention later. Alvin Hall is with us. 877-8-MY-TAKE is how you can reach us. Adora?
The economy, one big issue in the presidential campaign. Foreign policy, also an issue. Clearly, this presidential election has enormous ramifications for U.S. foreign policy, given how differently John McCain or Barack Obama would handle U.S. relations with the world. Safe to say, tens of millions around the world are watching how America votes. That includes Claire Prentice. She is the America correspondent for Scotland on Sunday, that newspaper, and she joins us from Las Cruces, New Mexico. Welcome.
Hi there.
Abdurrahim Fukara is the Al Jazeera Arabic Washington Bureau Chief. He joins us from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning, Adora.
I want to start by asking you both. The Economist has a global electoral college, and from 119 countries, 28,000 people have put their two cents in and overwhelmingly go for Barack Obama. That surprise you, Claire?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. This election really has, there's a lot of discussion here about media bias and is the U.S. media biased towards Obama. That may or may not be true here, but it's undoubtedly overwhelmingly true in the U.K. There's far more of an appetite for stories of Obama. I think his message of change really chimes with people in the U.K. and throughout Europe, and obviously from what this poll is showing beyond that.
Abdurrahim, what about for your viewers on Al Jazeera? What are their thoughts about the election, and what are their thoughts about the individual candidates?
I think they're overwhelmingly for Barack Obama for many different reasons. One of them is that he's African-American and he's seen as something of an underdog, although he's actually leading the race at the moment. But I think regardless of the color of the Democratic candidate, any Democratic candidate in this race would have been very popular in the Middle East against the backdrop of the Bush administration's policies. The President Bush as the representative of the Republican Party. And those policies, whether you're talking about Iraq or Iran or Syria or Lebanon, they have not been particularly popular among people. Among governments, it may be a different story, but among people, they haven't been very popular. So that leads me to conclude that regardless of whether Barack Obama is white or is black or were white, the support for the Democrats in this one would have been great in the region.
And what would you describe as some of the most important issues? Are we talking about Iraq? Are we talking about the war in Afghanistan? Are we talking about economic policies?
I think primarily it's Iraq. The invasion of Iraq in 2003 was not obviously very popular in the Arab world. It may have been popular among some sections of the Iraqi population itself, but people who were not directly exposed to Saddam Hussein's regime elsewhere in the Arab world, they never supported the invasion. And therefore, a lot of people are pinning their hopes on Barack Obama in terms of being able to shift that policy and get U.S. troops out of Iraq. Whether actually Barack Obama will be able to do that within his first 16 months in office, as he promises to do, is a different thing. There's a lot of talk about the success of the surge.
Mm-hmm.
The people who really know Iraq in the Middle East would tell you that if U.S. troops were to be withdrawn tomorrow, then the picture in Iraq would not be as rosy as John McCain is telling the electorate here in the United States. And therefore, the implication is that Barack Obama may not necessarily be able to change U.S. foreign policy in Iraq to the extent that he claims he wants to or he's going to be able to.
And Claire, what about in the U.K.? What are the issues driving concerns of people there?
I think the issues are very similar in the UK. I think the Iraq war is a big issue. I think there's a real desire to move on and put the Bush era behind us. This idea of a new dawn, which for British-American relations, which Obama promises, is very appealing. I think he brings the idea of a multilateral approach. He would be seen to consult with European leaders rather than dictating policy, and I think that is hugely appealing.
Claire and Abdurrahim, but in general, I mean, there's been so much interest on the part of the world as far as this campaign is concerned, and we're familiar in the United States with media outlets all over the world, you know, focusing on America's silliness, you know, Monica Lewinsky, that sort of thing, celebrity coverage, that sort of thing. Do you think this election campaign, Claire, provides the opportunity for nations to have a debate on the future of world policy in addition to focusing on the U.S., or is it simply a diversion? American politicians are kind of uber celebrities in some sense. Claire?
I think there can be some discussion, but I think, yes, it does. It does become bogged down. And I mean, for us, I think the length of it's extraordinary. Our elections tend to last about 5 weeks, which, judging from a lot of people I've been talking to here, is something that people are rather envious of. It's also, I mean, the expense of elections here is incredible for us. The huge personalities involved, celebrities coming out to endorse candidates, whether that's Springsteen performing in a concert.
So a real debate, but a sense of amazement there. I want to give the last word to you.
And also, I think with British politicians are not a glamorous bunch. The idea of spending $150 on clothes, let alone $150,000, is quite
so
really
true. Abdurrahim?
I think, as extraordinary a statement as it may sound, nothing that happens in the U.S. election is seen in the region as silly or as a diversion. I mean, for example, the image of John McCain wrenching the microphone out of that old lady's hand during that rally, when she said that Barack Obama is an Arab. A lot of people here in the United States, including Barack Obama's camp, was saying this is a diversion from the real issues of the campaign. But to a lot of people in the Middle East, that was a very serious issue that, you know, shed some light on how a lot of Americans may think about Barack Obama and how the American political system is actually constructed. And if I may say that large part of what we've been doing in this coverage is actually to try and explain the mechanics of the American political system.
Which can be confusing even to those of us here. Abdurrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera Arabic, Washington Bureau Chief, thank you. And Claire Prentice, America correspondent for Scotland on Sunday newspaper.
Perspectives from overseas. We're always on at The Takeaway. And Alvin Hall, should we have economic hope now?
Yes, but it's going to be 3 or 5 years away.
Well said. Alvin Hall, financial consultant and author of Show Me the Money. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And here's your takeaway.
No one can deliver a miracle in this economy. So if people are telling you that we can get your credit right, that we can go out and help you, you need to read the fine print.
That's Alvin Hall again. If you missed anything, it's all on our website at thetakeaway.org. You can also take our podcast to go each morning on iTunes. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
A presidential summation.
I am confident that you gentlemen will review without passion the evidence that you have heard, come to a decision, and restore this man to his family. In the name of God, do your duty.
Ooh, Barack Obama is calling this week his closing argument to America. It probably won't be as dramatic as Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird. But if voters do their duty, all of the campaigns will probably have more time with their families after next Tuesday, hoping for no hung jury on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 27th. Happy Monday to you, John Huckleberry.
Happy Monday, Adora.
Today, we're going to talk to an undecided voter and get a preview for what to expect from the two presidential campaigns this week in their last full week. Also, in two states, initiatives on abortion, one of them the first of its kind. And words, we have a twist today on what they do or do not mean this election cycle. First, though, we have headlines.
Fears once again of a global recession pushed world markets down today. Europe's major indices are down between 3 and 6%. That follows big drops in Asia. Hong Kong's Hang Seng lost 13%. And the 6% drop on Japan's Nikkei brought it to a 26-year low. The Dow futures are down more than 100 points. It would appear Wall Street is going to follow suit. But then, with the volatility at this level, it's never a certain thing. We'll have a close, an opening that's probably down on Wall Street, but it's anybody's bet what will happen after that.
As for politics, it's battleground states all the time as the candidates begin the final full week of campaigning. Barack Obama and John McCain both start in northern Ohio today. What are the chances of that, John? Both starting in the same place, and they end up in Pennsylvania. Obama is expected to deliver his closing arguments at a rally in Canton, Ohio, just after noon today. John McCain starts in Cleveland, and he's expected to continue to focus his attacks on Obama and key Democrats for their, quote, tax and spend policies.
Syria says the U.S. has committed, quote, a terrible crime. Syrian officials say four American helicopters killed 8 civilians in a raid on a construction site along the border with Iraq. U.S. officials have confirmed the attacks. And here in the U.S., the campus of the University of Central Arkansas is in lockdown, and classes are canceled today following the shooting deaths of two students on campus. April Hansen is a junior at the school.
Everyone's pretty nervous just because this is generally not something that's happened on this campus.
Officials say they have one suspect in custody and looking for three others.
The jury in Alaska Senator Ted Stevens' trial will start deliberations all over again this morning. The judge is appointing an alternate juror after one left because of her father's death. This means a verdict could be delayed until after the election. Stevens is facing a tough fight for his seventh term. Oil prices have fallen to a 17-month low. It's trading just below $62 a barrel. And gas prices continue to fall. They dropped nearly 53 cents a gallon in the past 2 weeks. A gallon of regular self-serve, well, it's $2.78 a gallon on average.
Philadelphia Phillies are one game away from winning the World Series. They beat Tampa Bay 10-2 last night. The Phillies could wrap it up tonight in Philadelphia. Economic numbers coming out this week, but what are your numbers? The debt consolidation and debt elimination industry has exploded during this economic crisis. What are you doing? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're watching global markets plunging once again, but that may seem like a ritual of the last few weeks, but every 4 years it seems like a political ritual that at this point in the campaign, about 8 days out from the election, we start to focus on the undecideds. Are they going to be decisive, and which way are they breaking? Well, it looks like in this case, in 2008, the undecideds won't be so decisive. There are many bigger factors moving voters in this election: increased turnouts, new voters, new kinds of campaign tactics that have brought different people into the race. But that doesn't mean the undecideds aren't worthy of some focus or won't be decisive in certain important electoral states. Andrew Kupka is an undecided voter, and he joins us from Atlanta, Georgia. Now, Andrew, you're still undecided at this point, right?
Yeah, good morning, John. Yes, I have not decided who I'm voting for yet.
All right, so you got 8 days, and on your to-do list is, like, buy groceries, fill up the car, get my car repaired, decide who's going to be president, all those things?
If it was only up to me to decide who's president, but...
then you'd really be undecided.
The weight of the world, yeah.
Well, do you think you're going to decide on Friday or maybe Thursday or next Monday? What do you think?
I haven't put a timetable on that. I know I have certainly till next Tuesday to make the decision. I know the candidate I'm pulling to win is John McCain. I'm definitely a conservative. I've always been that way. However, the way he's campaigned, the way he comes across, and the words he's spoken just haven't drawn me strong enough to me to pull the lever for him yet.
So your head says McCain, but your heart says none of the above.
None of the above that are on the presidential ballot. So there are a couple of other options I'm considering, one being the Libertarian candidate, who's Bob Barr,
right,
who's a former congressman from here in Georgia. And one that occurred to me over the weekend that I could just do kind of to get a head start on 4 years from now, but you know, you can write in, of course, a candidate, and I may even consider writing Sarah Palin in.
Writing Sarah Palin in. So you would be comfortable with Sarah Palin as president?
I would hesitate
to say that's a no. That's a no there, Andrew.
And that's, you know, why I sound so undecided, yeah. But that's kind of maybe would be more of a protest vote against the way John McCain has campaigned, against the way the Republicans have governed over the last few years.
Well, complicated stuff, and you've got a week to grapple with it. Andrew Kupka, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Andrew Kupka, an undecided but will be soon decided voter from Atlanta, Georgia.
The clock is certainly ticking. 8 days to go. A Reuters Zogby poll shows the race tightening, showing McCain gaining a bit, now just 5 points behind Obama, 49% to 45%. Joining us now to look at the big picture and the small picture is Marcus Mayberry, the editor for New York Times, or at least one of the editors at the New York Times, in the studio here with us. Welcome back, Marcus.
Great to be here.
First, are there many undecideds like our friend we just spoke to?
Increasingly fewer. It's a single digit now in every single poll we look at. The interesting thing about what Andrew is saying is that he is as he says, a conservative who at this point, and from the state of Georgia, which is a deep red state normally, who is not sure he's voting for. That is exactly endemic of the problem John McCain is facing right now.
He can't get the passion. He can't get people's fire in the belly going.
That's exactly right. There are talks now. If you look at, you know, the wonderful, we've done a great job this year of actually looking at the electoral college vote in the media rather than just looking at the popular vote. So if you, there are like at least half a dozen really excellent sites you can go online and look at different projections for the electoral college votes. Some of these sites are actually predicting things like Indiana is a toss-up, Georgia is only leaning McCain rather than solid McCain. Indiana has not voted for a Democrat since Johnson in 64. Before that, it was FDR in 1936. Imagine.
So that certainly says a lot, which is going to bring me to the point of mentioning this latest Zogby Reuters poll. National polls really are besides the point when you're 8 days out, right? You really have to look at the polls of the individual states.
All the national polls can tell us 8 days out is basically the trend lines. Are things getting tighter generally? If things are getting tighter generally, if it gets a smaller and smaller and smaller gap between the two candidates, and that's good because that means it's good for McCain. It means he'll be gaining in some states. The problem with the Zogby poll, though, five is not a bad number 8 days out. You wish it were tighter than that if you were John McCain. But the other problem is it's an outlier right now. We don't have any other poll with that small a margin.
Mm-hmm.
So unless we see other polls to confirm that soon, then it's not really good news for McCain.
Both candidates are in Pennsylvania. I got to figure with what you're saying that this Pennsylvania strategy on the part of McCain is an insane Doug Flutie, Hail Mary play that has almost no chance of success, and if anything is emblematic, that it's over.
Well, you know,
and just to throw into that, also the fact that McCain spent some time in Iowa over the weekend, which just seemed a little surprising, given the fact that Obama has had a lead of double digits in Iowa for some time.
And Republicans are getting really depressed from both the things you guys said. It's kind of sad that when McCain sat down and talked with Tom Brokaw on Meet the Press, it was in Waterloo, Iowa. That's a bad sign. Waterloo.
It wasn't Austerlitz, New York.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about what's happening in the McCain campaign. There's certainly been all of these reports in the last couple of days about the tensions between Palin's people, McCain's people, lots of finger pointing. Do you think this plays at all in the voters' minds, or is this just more emblematic of what their polling is showing and what their expectation is, the campaign that is?
I think both are true. I think it does reflect kind of the end days of a campaign when a campaign's not going well. You expect to see this, and you always do. On the other hand, I think voters do pick up these atmospherics. I think there's an increasing sense of kind of desperation that sits in a losing campaign, and it's kind of a lot of people, a lot of Republicans especially, but other folks too, are talking about how kind of sad this is for John McCain, who has been such a kind of a public civil servant warrior, a long distinguished career. But in fact, his last major campaign seems like it's going down in such a kind of a cloud of acrimony and even resentments. Barack Obama's going to be making his closing arguments this week. So he's going to be talking about appealing to people's hopes rather than their fears, bringing the country together. John McCain, in the meantime, is going to have to get increasingly negative and divisive in a state like Pennsylvania, hoping that beyond hope, from what all the polls tell
what
us,
do you mean
that
white voters,
well, you're right, he doesn't have to. But the way the McCain campaign is playing it is that they're going to go out there and get white voters in Pennsylvania who are a little leery about voting for this black guy. And we have a great story in today's paper about Pennsylvania and about some of the steel workers in areas that normally are deep red Republican areas of the state, saying, you know what, they admit to our reporter, I have a problem voting for this black guy, but and some even use other words that aren't African-American.
We can imagine.
and they say that I'm going to do it, though, because this is an economic issue. I've got no choice but to do this. It's quite extraordinary to see these Americans wrestling with these issues.
Does that mean Barack Obama has the potential of being a uniter in a way that we really haven't seen in a generation in the United States with all these divided electorates? Or is this just purely a response to it's the economy, stupid?
You know, I think it may be both. It may be the economy that makes it so that Obama may, and again, I don't think this election is over. I'm not willing to say that myself with 8 days left in the American election, with anything ever to happen over those 8 days. But it looks like Obama may, in fact, be that kind of person who, thanks to the economy, actually racks up a serious electoral college vote. And it's been a long time since we had one of those. We have to go back to Clinton Gore in 96, when Clinton Gore won with 379 electoral votes. To 159 for Dole and Kemp. And since then, the George W. Bush elections have certainly been, you know, really, really squeakers. And we have had a 50-50 nation. If we had someone who actually would assemble more than a 50-50 nation, actually unite Americans, even from the outset in the Electoral College, that would be an historic return to a different kind of America.
From where you're sitting, are there particular states that you're going to be watching closely? It appears that Barack Obama can win in several combinations of states, whereas John McCain is far more limited.
That's exactly right. I think, look at Pennsylvania. If McCain starts to actually make a difference there and narrow what still seems to be a double-digit Obama lead in Pennsylvania, then that will be an indication. Look at Indiana. If Indiana remains a toss-up, as many states or many pollsters are now calling it, that's incredibly bad news for McCain. If it were to move even closer to the Obama column, Then I'd be willing to say the election were over.
Marcus Mabry, thanks very much. He's an editor for the New York Times, and he's going to stick around with us for a bit.
What's the matter with Indiana? I guess that's the takeaway there. Lots of economic numbers coming out this week. What are your ideas for dealing with this crisis?
I'm wondering why we can't have the credit card companies lower interest rates. The government should intervene. What are all these senators and congresspeople doing on a day-by-day basis?
They did it before. We want to know what you're doing on a day-by-day basis. The government intervenes where? How? What do you think?
A word to the wise. He who does not economize will have to agonize.
We want to hear from you, but don't cry uncle. How are you personally responding to difficult economic times? Problem solver listeners on The Takeaway. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Economize and no agonize. That's pretty simple. Like that.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Next week, when the nation heads to the polls, in two states, voters will also be deciding on ballot initiatives involving abortion. This week, we're going to be taking a look at several initiatives, but today we start in Colorado and South Dakota and those two initiatives involving abortion. And for that, we welcome Johanna Saylor, a news producer at South Dakota Public Radio, and Megan Verley, a reporter at Colorado Public Radio. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with you in Colorado, Megan. First, describe this ballot initiative, and it's really the first of its kind to define a fertilized egg as a person. Explain.
It is. Its backers say that its strength is in its simplicity. It's only about 30 words, which is pretty short for a constitutional amendment around here. And it says, as used in sections 3, 6, and 25 of Article 2 of the state constitution, the terms person or persons shall include any human being from the moment of fertilization, so basically a fertilized egg. And those areas that it's referring to are inalienable rights, equality of justice, and due process of law. So basically, you would be defining person very, very early in the situation, and the backers of it say that it would be kind of a backdoor to a fetal homicide law and then also a way to position Colorado, if Roe versus Wade is ever overturned, to position it as a state that bans abortion from the outset.
We're going to talk about the reaction to it, but just very quickly, if you could describe to us the 21-year-old woman who's responsible for really spearheading this initiative.
She's, I think that's the key trait everybody's been focusing on, is that she is very young. I think she could definitely be called very idealistic. She's come out and said she's definitely anti-abortion, although she's not necessarily pushing the personhood amendment as an anti-abortion amendment. It's very obvious that it would have effects in that area. She hasn't been able to get a lot of support from many of the traditional anti-abortion groups that are usually active in these issues, but she's definitely been very visible in the state as a spokesperson for this amendment.
Johanna, in South Dakota,
yes,
a couple of years ago, 2 years ago, an initiative was defeated by voters. What's changed in this initiative that's trying to outlaw abortion?
Sure, the measure back in 2006 that went before voters, it did fail 56-44%, and that was a ban that only included an exception for the woman's life. The one that we're looking at 2 years later, now today, you know, on the ballot next week, has more exceptions. It includes exceptions for the woman's health or life if those were to be in jeopardy, carrying the pregnancy to term, and then also exceptions for rape or incest victims. There are some stipulations on some requirements they need to meet, like reporting the rapist to police through their doctor. But it does include more exceptions. It's something that supporters hope will give it that edge to win over voters.
But that, too, there's certainly been less support from some of the traditional groups that you might think. Could you describe the discussion that's going on in the state about the initiative?
Sure. The discussion is really focused on the ban's potential impact on the medical community. We've seen a lot of division among doctors in South Dakota. Some are saying that the law is so vague that even under the exception for the woman's health, no doctor's really going to attempt it because the language exactly used is accepted standards of medical practice. They say it's meant to be objective, but it really isn't. There's too much gray area. But then the other side says that it's not vague. In medical practice, there's always some gray areas, but it'll work itself out and doctors will be protected. So we're seeing that that bantering back and forth. So really it's voters that are going to have to decide which side they believe is accurate and
how's
what risk
it
they're willing to take.
How is it polling?
Well, so far, neck and neck. A poll just released over the weekend, 44-44, and then there's 12% still undecided, which is a huge chunk this close to Election Day.
Megan, now in Colorado, this initiative has been almost controversial beyond the people who are pro-life and those who are pro-choice. Even within the pro-life movement, there's been real strong reactions to it. I mean, you have the Catholic community is not supporting it.
Exactly. It's interesting how it's polarized. It basically seems like it's a battle that many of these groups don't want to fight right now. They're worried that if this goes through and gets in the courts and gets litigated and loses, because it is so short and in a sense so vague, that it could set precedent that would hurt future attempts to define personhood at conception. So there have been a number of groups that have said sort of, great idea, bad time. We don't want to have to, this isn't a battle we want to fight right now. I think it has an interesting analogy possibly to some of the gay marriage amendments that backers have come to see as being more harmful for their own side because of the polarization and because of the press than helpful to the overall movement. And so they have not gotten much support from any of the groups that I think people thought would traditionally jump in on it.
I mean, when you say vague, this law, some people understand it to mean that if a woman miscarried, for example, she could be held responsible if she did something like drove a car without a seatbelt, and that was the reason why she miscarried.
Exactly. That it opens up this whole door to negligent homicide in the case of miscarriage. A woman who drinks or uses drugs during a pregnancy and loses the pregnancy, or even just possibly damages the eventual child, could be held responsible for that. It also opens up a lot of areas with medical treatments, and that's something the opponents have really pushed, the idea that a woman diagnosed with cancer, could her doctor still prescribe aggressive chemotherapy, even though that would,
potentially put a baby at risk. Marcus
exactly.
Mabry, a editor at the New York Times, he'd like to jump in on this conversation.
I wonder what it would mean for IVF treatments, in vitro fertilization treatments, that so many couples go through today, and oftentimes that results in embryos being formed that aren't used productively in the process. What do
Megan, how would
say
that
about
work?
That?
That's another question. This is the interesting thing, is the opponents have been able to come up with a lot of hypothetical scenarios, and certainly in vitro fertilization, and would clinics have to keep those fertilized eggs? Would those fertilized eggs have rights on par with actual biological children when it comes to inheritance and other issues? The people who are backing the amendment say, this is all going to get sorted out in the state legislature. Let's stick to the simple text of it, which is that we want to say when you're a person. So they're making a very emotional argument, and the opponents have come up with a lot of scenarios in which it could become very hairy for the state.
Thank you both for joining us. Johanna Saylor is a news producer at South Dakota Public Radio, and Megan Verley is a reporter at Colorado Public Radio.
Be interesting to see if those drive people to the polls, those initiatives, and result in a change in turnout.
Well, that's the question for you, Marcus. You have about 8 seconds. Usually these issues
send people
to the polls.
Don't
this
even.
Time, yes
She's
or no?
She's suckering you, Marcus.
We'll see.
Nice.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 27th. Femi Okeh has just joined us with some headlines.
Thank
the
you
market's
very much.
Open.
Yeah, the market's open just about 2 minutes ago. The Dow is down about 120 right now. And Treasury officials say that they're ready to move on the first part of the financial rescue package after 9 major banks signed agreements last night. The government will use $125 billion to buy stocks in the banks this week, and it should help banks get rid of bad debt. In Asia, Japan's Nikkei index closed down more than 6%, hitting its lowest point in 26 years. Japan's prime minister is working to boost its economy. Prime Minister Taro Aso says that the government will provide more government funds for banks and tighter restrictions on short selling stocks. And the Syrian government is condemning a U.S. airstrike on its territory near the Iraqi border. Damascus reports that 4 children are among the 8 people dead, and a spokesman for the Syrian embassy in London says that the U.S. should not be threatening its security.
We are waiting for a clarification for this act of aggression from a country who's supposed to be a permanent member of the Security Council, and the main task of the U.S. is to maintain security and stability in the whole world.
A U.S. military official said the missile attack was aimed at al-Qaeda-linked foreign fighters crossing into Iraq. And that's a look at some of the main stories for this morning.
Thank you, Femi. And also with us in the studio is editor at our partner, international business editor, actually, our partner in the New York Times, Marcus Mabry, who will certainly relate to this next story. There is something in play in this election, and it's more than just the historical casting of women as the vice presidential candidate or the first African-American on the side of the Democrats. During this long campaign, far from being bored and tuned out, American voters seem to be more engaged than ever, with a growing interest in the campaign as time has moved on. Well, what does that mean? At the very least, it seems the language of political discourse may be in play, for the simple reason that you speak differently to people who are listening to you than you do to people who are tuned out. So for a look at how language appears to matter in this election and which candidate has been able to take advantage of it, we turn to writer Steve Almond. His latest book is Not That You Ask, a collection of essays and opinions about all things political and linguistic. Joining us from Boston, Steve Almond, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure, great to be here.
How is the language in play? And as I said, you talk differently to people who are listening and engaged than people who are, you know, tuned out and sort of wandering around not paying any attention.
Wandering around like wandering around on stage during a debate.
There you go. There you go. You said it, I didn't.
That's right. Well, but I'm a language expert. That's right. And actually, I think that's one of those moments where there's a physical thing happening that's reflecting in a weird way, but a kind of powerful, unconscious way, the thing that was happening with the language in those debates. You know, Obama began his political career with this ability to inspire. That's what he was famous for. And I think he keyed in on the fact that people on the left in the primaries were ready for a kind of overt compassion and idealism and lofty rhetoric. But as we've gone into the general election, I think he's really very shrewdly switched tack with the way he uses language. And the McCain-Palin campaign have shown a real inability to figure out what the unstated and sometimes unconscious rhetorical needs of the electorate are. I think of it as voters sort of come to the polls and come to the narrative of the campaign in the same way that readers come to books. They have unstated and sometimes unconscious rhetorical needs.
And they're willing to sit with it for a while as opposed to the soundbite era where it's all over in 20 seconds. Do you think in a moment where voters are engaged and focused on issues and problem solving, which it seems that has been the case, certainly since the economic crisis, you know, reared its ugly head, that soundbites are dead?
Well, I don't think soundbites are dead, but I absolutely agree that people are not focused on, you know, McCain had his I'm not Bush line, and it didn't register at all. I think, you know, if you look back to 2004, the Bush campaign said, how can we go at this? We're sort of wrong on the policies. People aren't excited about this war anymore. And they were able to portray Kerry as a flip-flopper, and Kerry's language, I was before this, before I was against it, really reinforced that underlying sort of character portrayal. The McCain campaign has been completely unable to do that with Obama, because while they're trying to make him out as some sort of dangerous, extreme, flighty celebrity, whatever the latest accusation is, Obama's language has been, if you'll notice, it hasn't been aggrandized. It's been very practical, very almost wonky and professorial. So there's this disjunction. The other thing that you mentioned is voters are really listening for specifics, for concrete solutions to the problems they're facing. They're not listening for the emotional appeal.
And soundbites don't cut it in that situation. Marcus, are you seeing that one candidate is better at articulating problem solving and the other is maybe sort of missing what the electorate's ears are tuned to?
John certainly has looked that way. I was struck again by looking at McCain's interviews over the weekend. He still doesn't seem to even be telling voters what his goals are, why he should be president. He keeps saying taxes, 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 and he looks literally another charge his opponents have leveled at him is that he's erratic. His language seems to be erratic. He doesn't complete sentences. He starts a thought. He doesn't give a complete thought.
Didn't hurt George Bush Sr. not completing sentences.
And that's interesting. I'd love to hear what we think of that.
Steve, what do you think? What do you think? George Bush Sr. didn't complete sentences. He wasn't a grammarian.
Look, this is a time when people are, if you listen to the debates, during the debate, this fella said to Obama, well, what does the bailout mean for me? He asked both candidates. And McCain did what he always does. as Marcus pointed out, he jumped around from one idea to another, and he made these kind of bald assertions. I'll fix it. Social Security, I just fixed that. Didn't you see me fix that? I know how to fix it, my friends. And that kind of unstated sort of assertion of competence isn't cutting it. Obama, by contrast, said, okay, here's what's happening. Here's what the bailout really means to you. If the credit markets freeze up, banks can't lend money, businesses are going to fail, they're going to lay people off. That's what we're facing.
But
and people really...
No, go ahead. People, I get what you're saying. People are responding to one and not the other. Is this a note for speech teachers to take into consideration at the conclusion of this election, or is the electorate itself in motion in a way that we haven't seen in a while?
I think it's the electorate. I mean, there's a real fault line in this election. When the economy started to go south in a serious way, that was the dominant issue. And even though people aren't yet, and I hope they won't, massively lose jobs and end up in real turmoil on quote-unquote Main Street, there was a real sense that a dark time was coming, and in response to that, who was going to be president and specifically what they want to do was the foremost issue. Character stuff, I think, got thrown out the window, and people started listening with a very different set of concerns that were, who is the most competent and steady in trying to solve these problems that are coming down the pike?
Set of themes, a great set of themes there. Thank you, Steve. Steve Allman from Boston, Massachusetts, wrote the book Not That You Asked, a collection of essays. He spoke with us about the political discourse in the United States and whether it's changing. You can't shout fire to a crowded theater if they're all listening to you. You have to say something more definitive, like you need to take these exits to get
right,
out.
Right, this is how
That's
you get
bites,
out.
Sound bites don't work. This,
That's a good analogy.
Yeah.
I get it now.
There
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks, Hawk.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. We turn now to Syria, where government officials are protesting today after what they say was a U.S. helicopter raid inside the Syria-Iraq border that killed 8 civilians.
It's really, the timing is very, very weird and strange, and this is an outrageous crime. I mean, you cannot implement the law of the jungle.
That's the spokesman for the Syrian embassy in London. Syria summoned U.S. and Iraqi envoys, and they are now considering their response. Joining us now is Borzu Deragahi. He's a correspondent for the L.A. Times in Beirut. Good morning, or I should say good afternoon to you.
Thank you very much. Good morning to you.
Borzu, are U.S. officials confirming that this attack, that they were involved in this attack?
U.S. military officials speaking anonymously to us in Baghdad and Washington have used language to strongly suggest that, in fact, they did conduct an operation in Syria, although they did not disclose any details about the operation. The language they employed suggested very strongly that this was a covert operation conducted by U.S. Special Forces.
Any sense of the people who they were that were killed in this raid?
Well, according to the spokesman for the Iraqi government this morning, this was an area, and he used rather cryptic language, this was an area known for Sunni Arab insurgent activity as a transit point for suspected insurgents entering Iraq, northern Iraq specifically. In recent weeks, in the past few months as well, there's been an uptick in alleged al-Qaeda-style attacks in the northern city of Mosul. There's been numerous acts of violence against the Christian community of Mosul that have been placed at the footsteps of the suspected al-Qaeda-style militants.
And what do you make of the spokesman for the Syrian embassy questioning the timing of the attack?
Well, I think it is curious, and the timing is definitely going to raise a lot of questions, especially with the ongoing elections in the U.S. I looked on the blogosphere last night, and there was a lot of talk about an October surprise. I don't think so, though. More like informed people that I've been talking to have suggested, yes, in fact, the timing was curious, as a little bit of payback on the part of a rather upset Bush administration against Syria for what it perceives as 5 years of troubles inflicted on the U.S. in Iraq at the hands of Syria.
Borzoug, quickly, what response do you think is likely from the Syrians other than words?
I think at this point, and that's one of the interesting things about the timing of this incident, I think that the government of Bashar al-Assad is hopeful that President Barack Obama is going to take office and that he's going to start a new kind of foreign policy that's a little bit less hostile towards Syria. And in that sense, I don't think they're going to do anything to spoil that possibility.
Borzoug Daragahi, thank you so much. Borzoug is a correspondent for the LA Times, and he is reporting to us from Beirut.
It's an indication that possibly unrest will spread into the Kurdish zone of their Mosul, the Kurdish region, which has been relatively peaceful. That border is definitely right there.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 27th. Femi Okeh is here, and she's got the headlines of the hour.
Hello there. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The leader of a major Mexican drug cartel was arrested after a three-hour shootout yesterday in Tijuana. Eduardo Arellano Felix is a senior member of a family cartel that's been vying for years for control of drug trading in Mexico. More than 3,700 people have been killed in drug-related violence there this year. Barack Obama received an endorsement today from the Anchorage Daily News, that's a major Alaskan newspaper. They say the choice of Governor Sarah Palin as VP running mate has brought recognition to the state, but that John McCain's still the wrong choice for president. Author Tony Hillerman died yesterday afternoon at the age of 83, and he's best known for his Navajo tribal police and mystery novels, which featured two American police officers. He actually wrote 18 in the series. Adora Udoji told me this morning she'd read all 18.
I have.
Give us a sense of his novels.
Is this going to be a quiz or something?
No, they're wonderful mystery stories.
Great characters.
Great characters. They're set in the Southwest. Intriguing events.
Thank you, Adora. I'm impressed that she's read 18 books of an entire series. Her mother is a librarian, so that
there
kind of fits all
I
in
know.
Very nicely. And Hillerman said that he always wanted Americans to better understand the Navajo, and I'm sure Adora certainly does that right now. And finally, it was an emotional day for Palestinian soccer fans yesterday. The Palestinian football team played its first international match in the West Bank in a brand new stadium, so they were playing at home for the first time. Rami Rabi was one fan who got to the game hours early and was very enthusiastic about the new stadium.
We want to show these people that they can be happy for at least these 2 hours watching this game and forget everything that's going on around them.
And until yesterday, the Palestinian team had played their home fixtures in Jordan or Qatar due to travel restrictions, and the Palestinians drew 1-1 with Jordan in the friendly game. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi. This next story combines religion and immigration policy and also business practices. Last spring, you may have heard it on this program, in fact, the largest kosher meatpacking plant in the country, Agriprocessors, in Postville, Iowa, underwent a massive raid by immigration officials. But after the raid, suddenly there were allegations that not only was the plant exploiting undocumented immigrants, forcing them to work excessive hours and subjecting them to verbal abuse, but there were also serious allegations that underage workers were on the company's books. Agriprocessors is the largest kosher meatpacking plant in the country, and its headquarters is in Brooklyn, New York. It buys about $100 million worth of meat each year. David Levine, a writer for Portfolio Magazine, writing in the November issue of that magazine, went into the inner sanctum of Agriprocessors and sought out the Hasidic rabbi Aaron Rabashkin in his Brooklyn office to find out the story from the perspective of the company and the perspective of the Hasidic community that is responsible for Agriprocessors. David Levine, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
First, describe how difficult it is to actually get what would be fairly routine in a normal business story, a kind of a no comment or this is our statement or, you know, this is how we plan to fight these charges when you're dealing with agriprocessors.
Well, this is not a sophisticated operation. And
it's big but not sophisticated.
It's very big, the largest or was the largest in the country. But it's not sophisticated, and they responded to the sort of flurry of controversy by closing up. And that has a lot to do with the sort of cultural background of the company. They're Chabad Lubavitch Hasidic Jews out of Brooklyn. So they responded by not responding to anyone, and it took a lot of work to say, look, it doesn't look great for you guys not to talk to anyone after all these allegations. You should probably give your side of the story to someone.
And what did you find when you got inside? I mean, is this a company that sort of dropped the ball and things got out of control, or was this a systematic, practice of really brutality on the job?
It's a difficult question to answer even now. I think the critics will say they knew exactly what they were doing. That, you know, obviously they knew the conditions in their plant. They had to have known that there were underage workers at the plant, and they certainly knew that there were illegal workers at the plant. And so the critics will say, well, these were sort of Dickensian taskmasters, that these were, 19th century overlords. That's what the critics will say. I think that there's also a degree to which these people were extremely unsophisticated, extremely naive.
When you say unsophisticated, what do you mean?
They operated their plant, the largest kosher meatpacking plant in the country, as if it were a deli in Borough Park, which is where the founder, Aaron Rubashkin, still lives. That really had an effect on the entire culture of the plant. Their attitude seemed to have been, well, we asked for documentation, and they gave us documentation. So what more?
If a worker said, hey, I'm 18, and show you a piece of paper, that's fine.
Exactly. And, I mean, the fact of the matter is that may pass in a local deli or restaurant in Brooklyn. People aren't really sort of scrutinizing you that much. But when you're a national corporation, you have to sort of conduct yourself in that way. And I don't think they ever made that cultural shift.
Broadly, how much are observant Jews drawn into this in the sense that, you know, if you buy sneakers from Nike and you discover that maybe it's not Nike, whatever company, you discover it's in a sweatshop in Thailand and worker issues are a problem, you're sort of drawn into it in some way. How are observant Jews drawn into these scandals given the level of allegations and the extent to which this company has made front page news?
Well, there was a great deal of sort of controversy in the kosher keeping community in the Jewish community, both among Hasids and among sort of more, say, secular denominations, less observant denominations. People said, how could a company that is a kosher meatpacking plant, if the allegations are true, run their company so unethically?
Because it's all about being moral.
About being moral, about being ethical, about abiding by biblical standards. And yet this is a kosher meatpacking plant that's accused of treating its workers in many ways worse than the animals they killed.
And what did the founder say?
Well, the founder said, you know, we run an ethical company. We paid them above minimum wage. Of course we didn't sort of intentionally go about abusing these people as some of the workers have accused, verbally abusing the workers. We didn't, you know, our factory was not in as bad a shape as some people say it was. You know, they say we ran an ethical company and we stand by that. That's sort of been their line.
In a sense, an unsophisticated response to a serious set of allegations that could result in serious hard time for both the runners of agriprocessors and the human resources people who were on line there in Postville, Iowa.
Absolutely. These are major, major charges. These are, and to some degree, they haven't sort of been handling it in the way that a national corporation would.
What hurt you the most, or what struck you the most about the level of abuse and the people who are workers there who are going to carry something, you know, longer than, you know, say, the headlines?
Well, I mean, it's the fact that, you know, so many of these workers left Guatemala and Mexico. They left abject poverty. They paid, in many cases, coyotes to smuggle them across the border. I mean, it was an arduous ordeal to just get here. And then to arrive in the U.S., this sort of land of promise, and to be working 13-hour days for $6.50 an hour in some cases, and then, as the allegations say, subjected to kind of sexual advances, to kind of constant verbal abuse at the plant, to wage exploitation, these sorts of things, what's sort of alleged in this case, that's pretty striking. And in some cases, some of the workers I talked to use the same term that they use for sort of, it's odd, but colonial overlords.
Yeah, yeah.
To refer to the supervisors at agriprocessors,
wow,
which was absolutely just striking.
Well, David Levine, congratulations on some great enterprise reporting in the November issue of Portfolio Magazine, the story of agriprocessors and the serious allegations they're facing as far as the use of underage workers and abusive tactics, as well as immigration violations on the workplace. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
We are always on at The Takeaway. Lots of economic numbers coming out this week, and we've been asking you for ideas on how to deal with this economic crisis.
I'm 76 years old. My wife and I were both Depression babies, came from very poor backgrounds, and we learned the value of a dollar. We pay off our credit cards the day after we get the bill, and the key to our financial success was staying out of debt.
Want to
be Secretary of the Treasury?
I know it's good advice for a whole lot of people. We want to hear your story about how you're responding and coping during these economic times. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
I don't understand why none of the candidates come up with the idea to, with people in foreclosures, to take their principal balance, whatever interest is owed, roll it into a new principal balance, give them a low fixed rate, and amortize it over 50 or 60 years like they do in Japan.
It's called refinancing, and it's getting more difficult with the credit crunch, but that's great advice from 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And if you missed anything, you can always take our podcast to go each morning on iTunes, or you can head to our website. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.